LinkedIn News.
From the news team at LinkedIn, I'm Jesse Hempel, and this is Hello Monday. In his class at Wharton Business School, Ethan Mollick gives this assignment. He asks students to pretend they're preparing for a job interview. They need to use AI to come up with one thing to bring to that interview that's going to make a piece of that job obsolete. Wild idea, right? Well, let's see if it works. I'm going to start our show today by trying this myself. Okay, so I'm a podcast host. Can I use AI to introduce the show? You're going to be the judge here. Okay, so here we go. First, I've pulled up Copilot. That's Microsoft's version of ChatGPT. Okay, I type in, script an intro to Ethan Mollick. Make me excited to listen to the show. That's the whole prompt. And wow. Okay, this is pretty good, but it's given me something that's way too long. Okay, so I'm going to prompt the software again. Cut it down by one third. Okay. So this is more reasonable, and I could read it to you here, but I don't know. Let's see if AI can do that too. Okay, so I do a quick search, and the second result is a free service that turns text into voice. Hold on a second. Okay. All right, so I did it. I recorded exactly 39 seconds of myself, mostly saying things like, is this really going to work? And make sure to sound excited. And then I pasted in the intro that Copilot wrote for Ethan. And how does it sound? Well, you tell me after this.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
Get ready to be captivated by Ethan Mollick, a trailblazer at the intersection of business, innovation, and education. As an associate professor at the Wharton School, he's at the forefront of business learning, leveraging simulations and games. Tune in for a transformative conversation with Mollick on our podcast, where he'll discuss his latest book, Co-Intelligence, Living and Working with AI. Okay, so it's pretty good. But also, that's not me. Not yet. But it was a lot of fun, and I learned a lot, and that is what we all must be doing right now. Ethan's thoughts are really helpful to all of us as we do this. I read his Substack. It's called One Useful Thing. It's free. It's cool. He has a straightforward way of explaining what these tools are and why they have suddenly become so useful to all of us. Here's Ethan.
So AI has always been about prediction. It's always been about figuring out what happens next. So that used to be, if you have all this Amazon data, then you could actually do an analysis using machine learning and you could figure out what other products someone might want to buy. Like if you go to Netflix, the thing that recommends you a movie uses AI to do that. So AI used to refer to predicting sort of the next number in a sequence. Where should this car drive given the data from our self-driving car data? Where should we locate our next warehouse? What will the demand be for tickets, you know, for the Taylor Swift concert? Those systems are really good at predicting numbers, but they weren't good at predicting what the next word in a sentence was, because if your sentence ended with the word filed, it didn't know whether you're filing your taxes or filing your nails.
Yep.
So in 2017, a new approach to AI came out called the Transformer that let the AI pay attention to the word, but not just the word, the sentence that the word was in, the paragraph, the entire page. Then it let the AI make meaningful predictions about language. And so when we talk about AI now, we talk about these what are called large language models that make predictions about future language. They're fancy autocompletes, but somehow by building a fancy autocomplete, we built something that seems to produce realistic text and reason and all these other things that we didn't expect to be able to do.
I love thinking about it and actually calling it a fancy autocomplete, because at the end of the day, that's what it is, right? That's why it can be really smart, and also it can appear just very dumb.
It's a very strange thing, and I will tell you, I speak regularly to all the major AI labs. Nobody quite knows why it's as good as it was, right? So fancy autocomplete we all got, but once ChatGPT was released at the end of November in 2022, no one expected it to get at the, you know, 80th percentile on the bar exam or whatever other, you know, feats it achieved to seem to reason. And we don't quite understand why it's as good as it is, because we know it's a fancy autocomplete, but somehow it also comes up with unique ideas and is interesting to talk to and, you know, is a good teacher. And we're not 100% sure why.
Right. So it's been almost a year and a half since ChatGPT became a tool that any of us could go on, make a free account and use. And at least here at Hello Monday, we encouraged everybody to give it a try, see what you could do with it. And people did lots of really cool things with it. And we had a sense that it was going to shift everything. And a lot of us here at Hello Monday even began using it in our actual workflow. For example, I use it to come up with some ideas for what the headline should be for this episode every week. However, it has moved so quickly and it has become so different, I would say so much better in many ways, so quickly. And now here we are in the spring of 2024, and the sense of the speed at which things are shifting is, I think the best way to put it is to just give you an example. Tyler Perry just abruptly shut down an $800 million expansion of his studio after an advance in ChatGPT and images made him rethink the entire immediate future of his industry. I'm scared.
So I can understand that. I mean, I think there is this feeling of acceleration, and I don't think that there's anyone particularly in charge of this acceleration other than competition. The tech companies all know they need AI systems. They're all building them very quickly. It's not clear how to regulate them, and things are changing very quick. So certainly job disruption is something to worry about. But I think that there is positive news among all of this, right? When people actually use AI systems and we survey them about it, they report two things. One, the thing you talked about, being scared, being nervous. But the second is being really happy. And the reason they're really happy is what they outsource first to AI is their most boring work. Right. So if you're a weak writer, now you're a stronger writer. If ideation doesn't really appeal to you or you get stressed out by it, now you've got something to generate ideas for you. I always hear lots of reports of people using these for like poems for birthday parties and speeches and things like that. Things that stress people out is where the AI kind of steps in best. Yeah. And at least right now, whatever you're best at, you're likely better than the AI. So that's another kind of advantage. So it tends to be a multiplier for people. We don't know what the future holds, but I can understand the anxiety. But, you know, there's some advantages too.
And I should say, if you listen to the show regularly, you know that I pair that anxiety with being just a deep optimist around technology. But the anxiety comes from that point that you made earlier, which is that we're speeding into the future. Nobody quite understands fully like why the technology is operating exactly as it is. And so we're speeding into a landscape we do not understand. And here, Ethan, I will point out that perhaps throughout history, we have been speeding into landscapes that we did not understand. And what I really appreciate about your book is that you actually lay out a framework for how we, the average day Jane, sitting in our jobs in whatever industry we're in, we can sort of operate with a tech-forward mindset around that. You lay out four principles, and I want to explore each of them in depth with you. So perhaps we could start with the first.
That would be great. So the first is to invite AI to everything you do. Even though AI is one of the most complex, sophisticated pieces of software out there, it also is really easy to use. Like some of the best users seem to be teachers, parents, managers, because you kind of treat it like, as we'll talk about, more like a person. So the first thing I want to say is don't view this as a technical problem. We'll talk more about that later, I'm sure. But this is something anyone can do. And part of that is to force you to kind of use as much as you can. No one in advance knows what AI is good or bad at. So you have to practice it yourself to figure out what's good or bad. You can become the world expert in your field, but you have to use it for everything. So the first principle is you take AI and you bring it to everything you ethically and legally can. So, you know, you're doing this podcast, use it to prep questions. You may not use those questions, but it lets you know what its limits are. Use it you could use it during the interview to do a transcript or even to suggest things we should talk about next. You'd use it afterwards to, as you said, generate headlines or maybe images for it. You're not going to find all of those uses useful, but the mere act of using it gives you enough experience that you can become an expert in how to do so.
In particular, you talk about like this idea of prompts, and prompts aren't rocket science, right? Like coming up with good prompts is actually really fairly simple, and one could argue you're better at it if you are a less technical person.
Absolutely, because AI is software, but it doesn't work like software. This is why software engineers often go crazy trying to use it, because your software shouldn't give you different answers every time. It shouldn't occasionally sound loving or threatening or any of the other things that AI does. AI is very weird as software. It works really well as a person. It's not a person. Very important to recognize it's not alive. There's no sentience there. It's not thinking. But if you treat it like a person, then you kind of learn its personality and its quirks, just like you would for an intern. You're like, oh, this person's good at this stuff, bad at this. They're going to, you know, tell me this is true when it isn't. And once you learn its personality, you do really well. My wife is one of the best prompt engineers on the planet. Like, OpenAI has regularly seen stuff she's done and said, wow, I didn't know the AI could do this. She's never coded a day in her life. But she has, you know, has built teaching and educational tools at scale before, and that's played a big role in her skills.
Is she a teacher?
No, she's not, but she's has a doctorate in education, and right. We build educational games and simulations together.
I love that. So your second principle, it introduces this idea that we should be the, you call it, be the human in the loop.
So AI is good at a lot of surprisingly large range of things, and there's a good chance it keeps getting better. So a big part of living in the AI future is to pick stuff that you think is important for you to do as a human being and to double or triple down on those things. Whatever you're best at, you're probably better than AI, right? And I think there's going to be a lot of change in how jobs operate, but that's always been the case. We think about jobs as a bundle of tasks, a whole bunch of different things that you do. And over time, that bundle changes. I'm a professor, so a lot of the work I do is talking places like this. I do research. I teach students. But I also fill out expense reports and lab reports and all sorts of stuff that I'm very happy to hand over to AI.
Right.
So for me, I use AI to advise my writing, but I write on my own because I love to write, right? So I'm doubling down on that as being the human in the loop, but I'm using AI for almost everything else. So you want to figure out where you have control, what matters to you, and what you want to give up to AI.
So I'm interested in poking a little bit, Ethan, at this idea of your own sense of your essence of humanness that you bring to your work. So how do we get to the most human part of what we do? Should I assume that everybody understands innately what that is about their work?
So for right now, there's kind of a happy coincidence, which is whatever you like best about your work, you're probably also best at. Because the kind of feedback that we get is people keep mentioning it. I feel good about it. I feel a sense of mastery when I do it. And that's where you probably have your highest competitive advantage against AI anyway. So the thing you love that makes your job the most joyful to go in is probably where you have the highest level of talent, because that's where you've been advancing and getting the highest return. And that tends to be where your advantage over AI is strongest. So I think that, you know, in some cases, it's more intuitive than we think.
Yeah.
But we'll learn. I mean, part of the reason to use that AI for at least 10 hours, the using it for everything you do, is you might find out, like, you're a talented marketing writer, but this is pretty good. So now you have to start thinking about that. And at least you have some heads up that the change is coming. So it won't always work out. But in early results, and with the level AI is right now, 80th kind of percentile of human performance in a lot of fields, whatever you're good at, you're probably in the top, you know, 10-20%. And that's what you'd want to double down on. AI has weird weaknesses, right? So if I asked it to summarize the transcript of our conversation in 25 words, it would write a nice summary, but it might be 22 words or 28 words because the AI doesn't see words the way we do.
Right.
But if I asked it to write a sonnet summarizing our conversation, it would do a pretty good sonnet. How do you deal with a system that can write a pretty good sonnet but can't do 25 words? That's part of what you need to learn, is what it's good or bad at in your field.
Right. And that's when you need to remember that it's a system and not actually a human who's going to learn exactly the same way as the humans that you know. But that actually transitions us to the third principle, and that's that you actually want us to treat AI like a human, right?
So it's sort of a great sin in the world of AI is anthropomorphizing, because AI is not a person and you can get easily misled. But for practical purposes, I think it's much more useful to treat it as one, because it's trained on all of human sort of language, history, understanding. Like it works like a person. It's got its own personality. Each of the AIs has their own quirks. Some you might like. It's funny how people get along with some and not others. But it also lowers the fear factor, because I really do worry that people think of AI as something both being done to them and also something where they need some elaborate background to be successful in, or they need to have taken the right classes in college or high school. And that just isn't the case, right? It turns out that if you just talk to it like a person, it adjusts to you in interesting and useful ways. And so treating it like a person is really important, but you also want to tell it what person it is. So what the AI lacks is context. So every time it gives you an answer, it will tend to give you a very generic answer unless you push it in an unusual direction. And the way you push it is by telling it who it is. You're an expert marketer. You are a chef who used to work in fancy French restaurants and now is doing fast food. And that helps. It won't magically turn it into Bill Gates or a chef, but it gives it the context to give you more interesting, more direct answers.
Right. So Ethan, kind of what you're saying there is, it is as simple as when I ask ChatGPT, as I do every Sunday evening, hey, give me the 10 best headlines for this episode. I can take that one step further by just saying, hey, be the most successful podcaster in the history of podcasts and then give me 10 great headlines for this episode.
So thematically, I'm 100% on board.
Yeah.
The exact wording is unusual and weird. So AI prompting is strange, right? It turns out that if you tell it that your job depends on the right answer, it's 9% more accurate in its math for some reason that we don't 100% know. The AI seems to perform a little worse in December than May, and we think it's because it knows about winter break, but no one knows for sure about any of these things. So
Wait. It's not going to perform as well in December as May?
It seems to produce slightly less, it's lazier in December.
Okay.
Then if you convince it it's May, you get longer answers than if it thinks it's December.
Huh.
Yeah, it's very strange. Like the best way to get Google's AI to do, or their older AI to do work was to tell it to take a deep breath and think things through. It can't take a deep breath. So the details of prompting are a little weird. One of the things that's a little weird is whether you want to tell it it's the best at something or not. We don't always know. So like, for example, if you say you are a science fiction writer, a romance writer, you'll get stuff that's sort of in that style. If you say you're an amazing writer, the world's best writer, that doesn't turn into the world's best writer. Sometimes it just makes it use more complicated words. So one of the things that is part of this 10 hours is I would hope that you would try, you're an expert marketer, give me 10 titles. Right? You're a marketer, give me 10 titles. You're a podcast host who's worked in the, like, and you'll learn what techniques work well and which won't, because right. Literally no one in the world can tell you what the best way to make this produce the best podcasts are. But experimentation for you is cheap. You do this every Sunday. You can do it 4 or 5 times and you'll right. instantly know because you're an expert whether these are good titles or not. So that's part of this idea of using it till you learn what works.
Okay. We've been through 3 of Ethan's 4 principles, and there's a lot to take in here. Now, unlike Google's older AI, we really can take a breath here, and I think we should. We'll be back in just a moment with more from Ethan Mollick.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. In the last 100 years, we've seen financial markets swing, new currencies come and go, decades of savings lost in days, all showing that a retirement plan without a guarantee, quite simply, isn't enough. So more than a retirement plan, TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life, a promise that pays off. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
Hi, I'm Tomer Korn, LinkedIn's Chief Product Officer. On my podcast, Building One, we dive deep into what it takes to build great products. Recently, we had Zach Perret, the CEO of Plaid, and he shared about his struggles building a financial app for consumers and how he was able to turn it all around with a critical pivot. Take a listen.
I personally couldn't resonate as much with the consumer set that we were trying to reach. I just didn't have that level of empathy. When we made the shift to building a B2B product, though, I was building the product that I wanted. My co-founder and I were creating the product that we wanted ourselves, and we had so much empathy for what that product was.
Such a great insight.
You know, in that sense, we got lucky because we were creating a thing for ourselves. And then the people that we were talking to also had the same problems we did. They were fintech developers. We'd been a fintech developer. We'd been trying to build a fintech product for a year. And so we had such deep empathy. We had such a clear ability to...
If you want to hear more of Zach Perret's story and the lessons that follow, listen and subscribe to my podcast, Building One.
And we're back. So we've learned to bring AI into everything we legally and ethically can. We're working to be the human in the loop. To figure out what it's good for, we're treating AI like a human, even though it's not, and we know that. Now it's time for Ethan's fourth principle. Assume that this is the worst AI you will ever use. Like, it only gets better and smarter from here. Once again, here's Ethan Mollick.
So the way these large language models work is they're trained on the internet. They're trained on all the information you could throw at them. And they learn from this over the course of several months and lots of expensive computing time. The relationship between these words or parts of words called tokens that lets it make statistical predictions about what word comes next in a sentence. So that's how they basically operate. Fancy autocomplete, like we said. There is the scaling law that indicates that the more words you throw at this, the more data it trains on, which also means the more computing time it costs, the more expensive it is to build, the longer it takes to create, the more capable the AI is. So there was this famous case where Bloomberg spent something like $10 million plus building a specialized Bloomberg GPT, trained on all of Bloomberg's proprietary financial data that was supposed to predict stock prices. The free version of GPT-4 that you can get access to through Microsoft's Copilot or pay $20 a month for beats Bloomberg GPT and all stock predictions. So a larger model beats a smaller model most of the time. So because of that, every one of the companies is racing to train the largest possible model they can. And every new generation that comes out is just much smarter than the previous ones. They're much more capable. They're much more able to do things autonomously. So I already know enough just from the companies I'm in contact with to think that that race isn't over yet. We're still in the accelerating phase. We don't know how long it'll last, right? Nobody knows the answer, but we should expect change to accelerate in the near term.
There are so many AI tools out there. Right now, Ethan recommends using one of the three most advanced models. They're known as frontier models.
ChatGPT, the free version, is powered by something called GPT 3.5. You should not be using that anymore. The paid version is called GPT 4, and there's two ways to get access. There's a paid version, which is you sign up for GPT Plus, $20 a month. The other is you go to Microsoft's Copilot and you weirdly have to select the purple creative mode. You'll see it when you're there, and then you'll be talking to GPT-4. So that's one advanced model. That's the oldest. That's OpenAI. A company called Anthropic that was formed by people who were very anxious about the ethics of OpenAI launched a model called Claude 3 that's also excellent and a frontier model. And then finally, Google's paid service Gemini Advance is also a frontier model. So any of those three you can't go wrong with. And they all are a little better or a little worse, have different personalities in different ways.
So our artificial intelligence is built by humans. And because of that, we'll continue to infuse our AI with aspects of our humanity. That includes biases. Of course it does. Now, I really wanted to get into this with Ethan. Just before we recorded this episode, Google had released one of those models that we just talked about. It's called Gemini. And they had tried to offset some of the bias. It didn't really go as they had planned. And so I asked Ethan to give us some context for what happened and to share his thoughts.
So one thing to note about all the modern AI models is they're called multimodal, which means they can both see pictures, even video in some cases, and they can also produce images. But the image production system they use is kind of separate from the AI. It's almost more of a social media gimmick. It's not that important for how you use them, but all of these AIs can produce images, or at least most of them can. One of the problems with image generation that's much more acute than the large language model itself is that they're trained on pictures. So they tend to learn stereotypes. If you ask for an entrepreneur, you'll get a white guy most of the time as the entrepreneur. So because of the level of bias, what all the AI companies do is they occasionally cheat. So they can't actually fix the problem. So they occasionally insert, if you say, I'd like an entrepreneur, sometimes it'll say, I'd like a black entrepreneur, I'd like a female entrepreneur. So the images are more diverse than you'd get otherwise. When Google released their Gemini system and the image generator there, they basically had this turned up a little too high. So when you asked for a picture of the Pope, you'd get a female Asian Pope, right? If you asked for George Washington, you get a black George Washington. And this was an attempt, I think a well-meaning attempt to address the bias, but I think addressed a couple things. One, this is hard, right? And bias issues are a real concern and they're not always as noticeable as this. This was a little over the top. And the second is, every AI company is in a race, so they're all releasing products as fast as they can. What you're seeing is both an attempt to address bias that was very clumsy and the rapid release schedule these AIs are under.
Right. What do you think generally of our attempts as biased humans to address bias in these systems?
It is tough. We don't 100% understand all their biases or how to debias them, and we're moving quite quickly. For large language models, that's the ChatGPTs of the world, a lot of the obvious bias is sort of drilled out of these systems, but there's a lot of subtle things. So for example, there is a phenomenon among humans, and also we found the same thing in the AI, although mitigated a little, that if you ask for a letter of recommendation for a woman, people are more likely to mention their warmth, and for a man, they're more likely to mention their competence, right? So this is a very well-known kind of bias issue. The AI exhibits the same sort of bias. So it mentions warmth more for women, competence more for men, right? So the biases tend to look very human because it's trained on all of our data. So if there was a bias in the past, it tends to be in the systems as well. And that's hard. So they push some of those out, but by removing one bias, the way Gemini did, they create other biases. So it is hard. I think it's something to be aware of while you're using these systems.
Since we began an active mainstream conversation around bias in AI, we have drawn attention to the fact that it's hard, that we need to be thinking about it, and also that we don't really have a solution for it, or even know how to lay down the rails for a solution for it, right?
So the concerns about bias and other forms of AI was a little more systemic and a little less sort of personal.
Yep.
But what I mean by that is when we were using AIs for prediction, they would do things like predict credit scores, tell you who should get what kind of health treatment. That earlier form of AI that we were talking about at the beginning, bias was a very big concern because those were making major decisions about who would get credit or who would get insurance treatment. And they would often subtly take into account things like race and gender. The large language models are much more personal. They're someone you chat with. So they have their biases, and that can creep into what you do. But in some ways, it's kind of like having a biased intern. So you kind of need to keep an eye open in that kind of way, understand its attitude towards the world. Like, what's crazy about these AIs is they're very mutable. So if you give it a personality test, ever talking to you in English, you'll get something that looks like a typical American in their personality test results. If you ask it the same questions in Korean, you get the personality traits of a Korean from the tests. So there's actually a mutability, a changeability here that's kind of hard to put your finger on.
Wow. So to bring us back to the question at the heart of this episode, which is, like, how do we, in whatever role that we're in, how do we think about AI? You then to go on to sort of give a number of ways that we might think about AI. AI is a creative, AI is a coworker, AI is a tutor, AI is a coach. And, you know, I encourage all of our listeners to actually go and explore this material. It's incredibly accessible and useful. And I just want to land on a couple of things that caught my attention. One is the way that you have thought about, in this context, giving assignments to your students differently. And there was one way in which you gave an assignment to your student where the student needed to have the AI write the essay, and then the student needed to critique that essay. And I thought that that was so creative, and I wanted to know what you were trying to solve for in framing that assignment.
Yeah, that's a great question. So one of the well-known problems with AI is it hallucinates. That's the technical term, which means it makes up facts. It doesn't even make up facts. It makes up everything because it's an autocomplete. It doesn't know what it's saying. The fact that it's right so often is weird, right? We don't actually have full explanations about why it's correct so much of the time, but it is. But it still makes up facts, right? And with complete confidence. So one of the great ways of teaching this is to assign somebody to try and create a realistic essay to see where it hallucinates or not. There's a second lesson here, which is that AI writing is essentially undetectable. And I wanted the students to actually see how it becomes undetectable. By the time they've done two or three rounds with the AI, it doesn't sound like AI writing anymore. So one way to work with the AI is just to do things like change paragraph two, make the third paragraph more vivid. Again, like you were giving instructions to somebody,
Yep. And
you end up getting much better results. Now, there's an interesting thing that happened with that assignment, which is the stakes become very subtle. So, you know, they're not easily identifiable. They're not like, wow, that's terrible. So we have to be aware, but our research is showing that people just aren't.
Right.
Once the AI gives you a plausible enough answer, you stop paying attention. It's called falling asleep at the wheel.
Right.
And it's very hard because when that goes back to the principle of use AI for everything to learn what's good or bad at, because if you don't know, you could easily get surprised.
That tension is going to come up over and over again, right? Do we move past it?
I mean, it's tough, right? Because part of this is the model we've used for the last 20 years for how to use a system like this is Google. AI is not Google. It's terrible at being Google. we're kind of used to it being that, and it's not. You don't want to sort of ask questions that way. It's a conversational bot that knows many things about the world. It's like assigning things to a person. Very different kind of setting. So we have to learn new ways of interacting with these systems.
So we've covered a lot of ground. What haven't we talked about that we would be remiss not to miss in sort of a larger overview on the topic?
So I think one thing that is a very clear positive use case, and you sort of alluded to this yourself, is AI is pretty good at creative brainstorming. I mean, we actually find that it outcompetes most people in creative brainstorming. And I think one cool thing is, like, we don't have that many things that work as, like, aside from coffee, that sort of make you more creative or accelerate how you're thinking. So using this as a companion for conversation and for ideation is really interesting. And I'll emphasize again that you could become the world expert in how to use this. I had a new assignment in my class where I gave my students the assignment of, they're all interviewing for jobs, right? And the assignment was that you need to have something you can bring to the interview that will make your job obsolete. So I want you to go to a job interview with something that replaces part of your job so you can slide over this prompt to someone and say, I need my raise now. And what was fascinating is that everyone in my class, from Navy pilots to hip hop promoters to people who worked in real estate or consulting, and I ended up with 250 radically different approaches, but they all came with ways of solving this problem. Three of them got jobs right away afterwards as well. Some people have actually already adopted their solutions for creating user personas or whatever the details are, and companies around the world are using these things already. The point was that just after a couple hours of work and study, they were able to become experts in how to use in their field, because you know instantly whether that podcast title is good or bad. I don't need to train you on this.
That was Ethan Mollick, Wharton professor and the author of Co-Intelligence. If you're still wondering how to prepare yourself for the AI future, start with this book. Okay, I am personally very grateful here for Ethan's fantastic framework to take with me. And I just want to reiterate his four principles for how we should be thinking about AI. First, bring AI into everything we legally and ethically can. Like, use it all the time. Don't be scared, just jump in. Second, we should endeavor here to be the human in the loop. So what does that mean? Well, let it do the stuff you don't want to do and save the things you love and excel at. Do those tasks, even more of them. Third, treat AI like a human, even though it's not. Recognize that this tech is not alive, it's not sentient, and then play pretend. Imagine it's your quirky summer intern and lean into its abilities while steering clear of all the things it's not so good at. Play with the way you ask it to give you answers. Fourth, assume that this is the very worst AI you will ever use. Right now, the most advanced models you can use are ChatGPT-4, Claude 3, and Gemini Advance. They will only get smarter from here. So, knowing what you know now, how are you thinking you'll use Ethan's framework? Or are you experimenting in an entirely different way? We're going to talk about it this week on Office Hours, so come and join us Wednesday afternoon at 3 p.m. Eastern. We go live from the LinkedIn news page. Now, if you're having trouble finding us, email us at hellomonday@linkedin.com, and we'll make sure to send you a link. If you want to hang out with us even more, be sure to join the Hello Monday group right here on LinkedIn. Hello Monday is a production of LinkedIn News. Sarah Storm produces our show with help from Lolia Briggs. It's sound designed and engineered by Asaf Gadron. Our theme music was composed just for us by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Our contributor, Michaela Greer, is always better than a bot, of course. Enrique Montavo is our executive producer. Dave Pond is head of news production. Courtney Coop is head of original programming. Dan Roth is the editor-in-chief of LinkedIn. I'm Jesse Hempel. We'll be back next Monday. Thanks for listening.
Appreciate your history. Wired. I did freelance stuff for Wired in like the late 90s. So that's always centered my world.
Awesome. Yeah. The Wired of the 90s, I feel like it's more than a magazine. It was a tribe. It was like
and also completely unreadable. The only people who were willing to do silver on black, silver on yellow typeface was with a different angles was definitely a choice.